headlines. Russia's UN envoy says the ongoing crisis in Ukraine is rooted in almost 8 years of crimes committed by the Ukrainian nationalists in eastern Donbass region. The EU foreign policy chief says the bloc will provide 500 million euros in lethal and non-lethal aid to Ukraine while closing all airports to Russia and banning Russian media outlets. The Iranian president says Tehran is ready to help restore peace to Ukraine and supports any diplomatic effort aimed at the peaceful settlement of the crisis. Thank you for joining us. And our top story, Russia's envoy to the United Nations says the ongoing crisis in Ukraine is rooted in almost 8 years of crimes committed by Ukrainian nationalists in the eastern Donbass region.
This crisis broke out not as a result of the launch of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine, but much earlier, when for 8 years you turned a blind eye to the crimes perpetrated by the Ukrainian nationalists in Donbass.
Nebenzia also accused the Ukrainian nationalists of posing threats to their own people and civilian infrastructure. He rejected accusations that the Russian military is targeting civilians in its operation in Ukraine. The ambassador also slammed the West's disinformation campaign on the Ukraine conflict. During the UN Security Council meeting, the US ambassador, however, criticized Russia for what she called an unjustifiable assault on Ukraine. Linda Thomas-Greenfield said Washington would continue to support the Ukrainian government by providing it with additional military aid. Meanwhile, the 15-member council voted to refer a draft resolution on Russia's military operation in Ukraine to the General Assembly. The U.S.-sponsored draft received 11 yes votes. Russia voted against it, while China, India, and the United Arab Emirates abstained. Russia's military operation in Ukraine is now in its fifth day, with fighting expanding to more areas across the country. The Ukrainian government says troops are in full control of the second largest city, Kharkiv, that is, after a Russian attack. Russian forces have targeted a gas pipeline near the city, as well as an oil depot near the capital, Kiev. Moscow says its forces have entirely besieged the southern Ukrainian city of Kherson and the southeastern city of Berdyansk. In Kiev, the Ukrainian army says it is holding the line around the capital, but it's fighting Russian sabotage groups that have infiltrated the city. It also says a Russian tank company has been destroyed near Kiev. A senior advisor to the Ukrainian president says Russia is losing initiative in its attack and has suffered heavy losses.
Russia has lost the initiative and is now unable to continue active hostilities. In my estimation, in the estimation of other military experts, the insane losses they have experienced and the resistance of the Ukrainian people and the Ukrainian armed forces and the thwarted plans of their first 3 days of the campaign show that the further perspective of offensive action in Ukraine is futile.
Ukraine's foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, says Russia's goal is to destroy his country, but he stressed they will not fall and give up a single inch of their territory. In Russia, the defense ministry says its armed forces have hit more than 1,000 Ukrainian military sites since Moscow began its military operation on Thursday. The ministry has also confirmed deaths and injuries among Russian servicemen without specifying. So far, nearly 200 people have lost their lives in Ukraine. That's according to the government there. And the UN Refugee Agency says nearly 400,000 have fled the country. It says the number continues to rise. The Russian president orders his military command to put the country's nuclear forces on high alert over what he calls the West's unfriendly measures.
Dear colleagues, as you can see, not only do Western countries take unfriendly measures against our country in the economic dimension, I mean the illegal sanctions that everyone knows about very well, but also the top officials of leading NATO countries allow themselves to make aggressive statements with regards to our country. That's why I ordered Defense Minister and Chief of the General Staff to put Russian Army deterrence forces on high combat alert.
Vladimir Putin's announcement drew a reaction from the Ukrainian foreign minister. who said Putin's move is aimed at increasing pressure on the Ukrainian delegation during the upcoming talks. The top Ukrainian diplomat said his country will not give in to Moscow's pressure. The two sides are set to hold talks at the Belarusian-Ukrainian border. Earlier on Sunday, Kiev refused to hold negotiations in the Belarusian capital, citing what it called hostile actions from Minsk. The European Union's foreign policy chief says the bloc would support Ukraine with more lethal weapons, including warplanes.
And we want to do everything to support Ukraine. We have decided to use our capacities to provide arms, lethal assistance to the Ukrainian army by a value of 450 million of support package and 50 more millions for the non-lethal supplies, fuel, protective equipment. We have technical ways of doing that. And certainly we are going to supply arms, fighters. We are going to provide even fighting jets.
Joseph Borrell says the EU would continue to support Ukraine despite Russia's nuclear forces being put on alert. He says the bloc has taken what he described as crippling measures against Russian financial markets, including the exclusion of some Russian banks from the SWIFT payment system. Borrell notes the EU is also closing its airspace for Russian air traffic. He has also expressed concern that the ongoing conflict and the crisis triggered by Russia's attacks on Ukraine could spill into neighboring countries, including Moldova, Georgia, and the Western Balkans. Joining us for more on this special coverage is Richard Becker, anti-war activist with the Answer Coalition from San Francisco, and Tony Gosling, historian and investigative journalist from the British city of Bristol. Gentlemen, welcome. Richard, if I start with you, you know, is Russia and its media outlets, as the EU foreign policy chief just said, is propaganda and therefore must be banned, trying to blackmail everybody and win points from the current situation?
Well, it's very hard to say. I mean, I think we're in a situation right now of the fog of war. That is that there are reports that are coming out about different aspects of the military campaigns, and they're quite contradictory to each other. We don't really have a way to know from afar. Certainly when when war begins, the mass media of each side plays a role in the war. We know that very well from living in the United States, where despite the assertions that we have a great free press, the mass media becomes a part of the, and I'm not saying this is the same thing going on right now there in Russia or Ukraine, but here I know that the mass media becomes the state media, and it becomes the war media. And as people have said, national public radio becomes national Pentagon radio, and maybe not just at that time, but all of the networks are here, the major networks are all reporting the same thing. They're all highly, highly prejudicial against Russia. They give no credence whatsoever to the reality that it's NATO that has brought this crisis into being by their strategy, their relentless strategy of surrounding Russia and refusing really to meet any of the demands of Russia.
Right. Let me just bring in Tony. Tony, EU officials say they want Ukraine in the bloc, adding, "They're one of us." That's a quote. But before you guys join, here's another $500 million in military support. Here are some warplanes. Just fight the Russians, and then you're one of us. You can be a member of the bloc.
Well, I mean, let's not forget that it was the European Union that were very much involved in installing a pro-Western government in Kiev in the coup of 2014, which all of the Western press seems to have forgotten about. I mean, we really are moving into a demented, deranged press world where only one side's information is going to be looked at talked about. The basic fact is that back in December, the Russians said the security situation in Eastern Europe needs to be sorted out. You have pulled out of various treaties, and so we've got to fix this. The West, NATO, the Pentagon, the British, and the European Union all turn their backs on Putin. Of course, it's a serious consideration for the Russians to make sure that they're not having all the weapons that then poured in, weapons then started pouring into Ukraine. Of course, the Russians felt like they had to do something about that, and they've realised that the diplomatic channels have been slammed in their faces. And so, as a result of that, they have decided that the only option for them is to take military action on the ground. None of this has been reported really in the West at all, nothing. It's becoming a propaganda war where one side speaks to itself and the other side speaks to itself.
Right.
And there's very little in between.
Right.
I don't want to say that the Russian media or any media, actually it's probably the Middle Eastern media like Al Jazeera and yourselves that have been more balanced on this subject. For example, one of the main stories that's not at all been covered here in the West whatsoever is the Ukrainian army, which has been lodging itself and embedding itself in civilian areas amongst tower blocks and this sort of thing. In order to make sure that if the Russians want to shoot at them, then they're going to have to shoot into civilian areas. Now, this is not being reported here at all, but it's a very important fact that people need to know to understand what's going on. And we're not going to get, I don't think, in the future, any kind of balanced reporting, particularly from here in the West. My experience working many years ago at the BBC tells me that they have now decided that the big corporations, the big media corporations, many of whose money, by the way, is squirreled away in tax havens, that they are going to just simply back
right.
the
Tony,
West
bear with me.
In its attacks on Russia, into the indefinite future now.
I'll get back to you, Tony. Richard, what do you make of the Russian ambassador to the UN just a few hours ago accusing the U.S., our light's gone, accusing the U.S. of a disinformation campaign that this conflict started on Thursday morning and that there was no fighting in the breakaway Donbass region over the past 8 years, or something called the Minsk Agreement that granted autonomy for the Donbass but was never granted?
Well, you know, there has been one broken agreement after another, and this disinformation just continues nonstop. But there was an agreement in 2014 to end the demonstrations and withdraw the police, and then the Nazis attacked. I mean, they were real Nazis, and they overthrew the government there. So that agreement was abrogated. Minsk 1 and 2 were abrogated by the Ukrainian government side. There was shelling, there were casualties, many, many casualties in the eastern part of the Ukraine. It's very important to take note of, you know, along with the JCPOA, with Iran, these other broken treaties in 2019 was the abrogation by the United States of the INF Treaty, which paved the way for the reintroduction of intermediate and short-range missiles, which can be nuclear-tipped, into the NATO states, and with the idea that they would be introduced into Ukraine, and Ukraine would become the kind of final seal on the border, or almost the final seal on the border with Russia, and if it was part of NATO now, and the INF Treaty is abrogated, then the door is open to those missiles being 5 or 10 minutes away from major population
right.
centers in Russia.
Sure. Richard, let me just switch back to Tony. Tony, you know, Russia argues there's a loud yet powerful minority governing Ukraine that are dictating to the vast majority of others how they view their history. If you can give us just a short answer on that, then we'll get back to you.
So I think the thing that people need to understand is just what it means to be a member of NATO. That nowadays, I'm afraid, what that really means is that your intelligence services are controlled through NATO. So even for countries like Croatia, as they're joining NATO, they have to understand they're handing over their intelligence services to another organisation actually based in Brussels. And as the intelligence is taken over by the NATO Then what happens is then that intelligence services is used to spy on all the democratic institutions, such as the judges of the country, the lawmakers, the MPs of the country are spied on by the NATO intelligence services. Also the journalists are spied on by the NATO intelligence services. And this is the method by which the NATO is actually far, far more political power than people give it credit for. You'll also find, by the way, that there is one good thing about all this crazy propaganda, that even though it convinces many, many people in the target countries that, you know, in this case, Putin is demonised successfully, if you remember back in the Second World War, the great British writer George Orwell, he resigned from the BBC because he said there's no point in this propaganda. It only brings you short-term gains. And at the end of the day, these things will have to be fought out on the battlefield somewhere.
Okay.
And that is where these big decisions are going to be made, ultimately. So by going down this propaganda route, NATO and the NATO countries have basically set themselves on the road for World War III. And so we need to be talking. We need to be opening up those diplomatic channels, or else that's almost a one-way street.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your time. Richard Becker is an anti-war activist from the Answer Coalition joining us from San Francisco. Tony Gosling is a historian and investigative journalist joining us from the British city of Bristol. Now, moving ahead to the Iranian president, who says Tehran stands ready to help restore peace to Ukraine and supports any diplomatic efforts that would result in the peaceful settlement of the crisis. Ibrahim Raisi said Iran understands Russia's security concerns over NATO's decades-long expansionism, but at the same time, he underscored that Iran underlines that territorial integrity and national sovereignty of all countries should be preserved. He said Tehran does believe that diplomacy, as well as sincere compliance with international obligations by all parties, is the only lasting and fair solution to the current crisis. He also urged all sides involved in the Ukraine conflict to protect the lives and property of civilians and observe international law and humanitarian principles. The president also called on his country's relevant bodies to immediately do whatever it takes to protect the lives of Iranian nationals in Ukraine. Well, that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Palestinian Bedouins know the Israeli regime has long used afforestation as a way to seize lands in the Naqab and elsewhere, and to hide the landmarks and ruins of Palestinian villages after the regime destroyed and ethnically cleansed them, says Ahmad Abu Artema, writer and political activist, in an article titled, "The Naqab is a key piece in Israeli regime's apartheid puzzle." Stay tuned for more. The first of this month, Amnesty International issued a report that declared the Zionist regime an apartheid regime. Whether Palestinians live in the besieged Gaza Strip, in East Al-Quds and the rest of the occupied West Bank, or within the occupied territories itself, the Zionist regime treats them as an inferior racial group and deprives them of their rights. The report highlighted the southern Naqab region as a prime example of the Zionist regime's long-standing policy to appropriate Palestinian land and resources to benefit Jewish Israelis. Weeks before the publication of the Amnesty report, Palestinian Bedouins in the Naqab had been resisting renewed Zionist regime's attempts to expropriate large swathes of land under the guise of afforestation. Last month, the Zionist regime forces cracked down on protesters, fired rubber-coated steel bullets, and dropped tear gas canisters using drones. Dozens of Palestinians were injured, and Zionist regime authorities reportedly detained more than 80. The Zionist regime police also fired sponge-tipped steel bullets against protesters, injuring 5 in the head, Haaretz reported. One Palestinian teen who was a bystander at the protest lost an eye after the Israeli regime police shot at him. The Jewish National Fund and the Israel Land Authority are seeking to expropriate more than 11,000 acres of Palestinian land to plant trees, Al Jazeera reported. But Palestinian Bedouins know the Zionist regime has long used afforestation as a way to seize lands in the Naqab and elsewhere, and to hide the landmarks and ruins of Palestinian villages after the Zionist regime destroyed and ethnically cleansed them. It is the Zionist regime's signature method of erasing all traces of its crimes. The Zionist regime has adopted various policies to Judaize the Naqab since 1948, most notably designated large areas as nature reserves and industrial and military firing zones around Bedouin villages, as noted by Amnesty. The Zionist regime corralled Bedouin residents and forcefully transferred them to what it called planned townships. This has had devastating consequences for the Palestinian Bedouins who live in the area. The Zionist regime still refuses to recognize 35 Bedouin villages in the Naqab, thus cutting them off from electricity and water supplies and targeting them for demolition, Amnesty reported. In December, the Zionist regime occupation authorities demolished the Bedouin village of Al-Araqib in the northern Naqab desert for nearly 200 times since the year 2000. The Zionist regime demolished more than 10,000 homes in the Naqab between 2013 and 2019, according to Human Rights Watch. In 2013, the Knesset, the Zionist regime's parliament, approved the so-called Prior Plan designed to forcibly displace residents of dozens of Palestinian villages in the Naqab and concentrate them in a segregated area. Under this law, the Zionist regime would have forcibly displaced 70,000 Bedouins from the area. The 35 unrecognized villages would be demolished. For now, popular protests and the condemnations of many international bodies have forced the regime of Israel to suspend implementation of the plan. These projects are designed to drive Palestinians out of the region and replace them with Jewish Israelis. Since it was founded on the ruins of Palestinian cities and villages in 1948, the fake regime of Israel's strategic colonial goal has been to steal Palestinian land and forcibly displace its native population. From far north of Galilee to the southern Naqab and all around the occupied West Bank, including East Al-Quds, the Zionist regime continues to pursue this goal. As the Zionist regime forces attacked protesters in the Naqab last month, occupation bulldozers demolished the Salhiya family's home on a cold and rainy night in Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of East Al-Quds, leaving the family homeless. Residents of Naqab recognize the national significance of their cause. The plight they face is the same one endured by the entire Palestinian people. Some have named the Zionist regime's crackdown and forced displacement of Palestinians in the Naqab as a smaller-scale version of the Nakba. The 1948 ethnic cleansing of nearly 800,000 Palestinians to make way for the Zionist regime. "They treat us like refugees in our own land," Palestinian activist Aidan Hajjouj told media in the Naqab last month with revolutionary ardor, adding, "This is not their land, this is ours. We have been here since before 1948, before Israel became Israel." Amnesty's apartheid designation follows that of Israeli human rights group B'Tselem and Human Rights Watch last year. These reports alarm the Zionist regime because they undercut the false image it tries to project to the world. The Zionist regime's designation as an apartheid regime shifts the focus from a tunnel vision view of the conflict within the occupied West Bank and Gaza to setting the problem in the very essence of the fake regime of Israel. As Amnesty reports, since its establishment in 1948, Israel has pursued an explicit policy of establishing and maintaining a Jewish demographic hegemony and maximizing its control over the land to benefit Jewish Israelis while minimizing the number of Palestinians and restricting their rights and obstructing their ability to challenge this disposition. Palestinians then are rejecting a racial regime. Since its founding, the fake regime of Israel sought to separate the Palestinian people and fragment their national identity. Palestinian citizens of occupied territories are those who survived the Nakba of 1948 and their descendants and were able to remain in what became the fake regime of Israel. Depending on where they are geographically, the Israeli regime classified Palestinians through a hierarchy of identifications with political, security, and legal implications. The Zionist regime's systematic racial discrimination against the Palestinians in the vast territory occupied in 1948 contributed to the growth of Palestinian patriotism. That Palestinian patriotism, partly suppressed for decades within modern-day Israeli regime, was recaptured in May 2021 as Palestinians widely protested the Zionist regime's military assault on Gaza and the Zionist regime's encroachment on Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. As Amnesty International states in the executive summary to its apartheid report, in a display of unity not seen for decades, Palestinians defy the territorial fragmentation and segregation they face in their daily lives and observed a general strike to protest their shared repression by Israel. That unity from the Naqab in the south to the Galilee in the north, Gaza and the West Bank, is essential to moving off the failed two-state model that does not secure all Palestinian rights and galvanizing Palestinians toward a movement for one state that upholds key principles such as equal rights and the right of return.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Kazem Ali Himani and Sheikh Qasim. Assalamu alaikum to both of you and welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, brother.
Alaikum Sheikh assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Let's get to today's topic, which is the foundation of family in Islam. Why the religion of Islam emphasizes very much on establishing the family, taking the wife and having children, but inside the wedlock, which is the legitimate Shari'i system of thought, something which is unfortunately very much missed in the nowadays liberal capitalist lifestyle of the Western world. Sheikh Qasim, let's start with you. Why so much emphasis on establishing a family?
Yeah, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. First of all, I think, actually there are many aspects that we can't actually talk about with respect to the importance of family. Let's talk about the social effects of family. The first and the most maybe important of social institutions actually is family. So the social life of a person starts in his or her family.
Yes.
So it's so important, actually, that person that is born into that family is going to be reared by his or her father and mother, parents in that family, and the upbringing that is receiving starts from that institution, and it's going to affect the whole life of this person, you know. So that's one of the actually aspects of the importance of the institution of family.
Okay.
Another one is that, all those developments and progress mm-hmm. that a person can go through and achieve can be flourished in his or her family. And so that's actually another okay. aspect of the importance of family.
So not any single man or woman who are living under one ceiling in one house can be considered as a family in Islam.
Yeah.
This is something, unfortunately, we can see in the new styles of the family, in the world nowadays, which is out of the old style, as they call it, type of the families and the family foundation around the world.
Yeah. Okay. Not all of them. You know, we may have some families that have lost their father or mother and their families. But the ones that are not actually intending to have, the whole members of a regular family. Yeah. So that are not actually regarded not only by religions but even by the convention of human beings from the very beginning.
Exactly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's not the way.
It's just not about Islam. If you look at all the cultures around the world, the ancient cultures and the cultures right before this neo-modern world, all cultures encouraged marriage and considered it to be a holy and sacred thing. They had a perspective that this is a sacred thing. Not just that, if you look at psychology, you look at Abraham Maslow, he says, look, human beings have some basic needs. And he starts off the hierarchy. In the hierarchy, he says, you have the basic needs, food, water, shelter, and sex. And then he says, next is your security needs, that you need to feel secure. And third, and the most important one, is your social needs. And he says, you need to live in an institution. You need to be connected with people. And this is where marriage comes into perspective. Mm. So it's not just about Islam. It's all cultures around the world that consider marriage as an important aspect of human life and consider it to be a very sacred thing.
The case is with this sacredness of the family, because nowadays you could find it in the media and this new style of the family that they are violating this sacredness of the family. They want to take it out, this sacredness, and make it as something, okay, one man and woman, or two men or two women, you know, a single parent, you know, they can leave, and this is also a family. For example, if a mother takes care of a child and works out as a single parent without marrying, for example, a man, this also could be seen as a family. I do want to say, what are the negative aspects of this look at the family? At last, they might say that in the Western type of lifestyle, all these type of new families fit. And they fit exactly into the new lifestyle of the people. We have no problem with that. What's wrong with that?
Yeah, actually, you know, the thing, I believe that your, you know, the stress of your idea is on the, you know, the coexistence or the cohabitation of, for example, two persons from, you know, the same sex or from, you know, different sex.
Yes.
Whether they have child or not.
Okay.
You know, that... you know, the problem that actually is with that sort of life is that it's not based, you know, and promoting such lives, you know, is based on the way that the West actually looks at the things.
Mm-hmm.
And it's originated in the strategies that the Western culture, unfortunately, for the last 3-4 centuries, maybe more than that, are based upon and laid out actually on those foundations, which is, you know, the importance of interest and pleasure. So that is the, you know,
the sexual satisfaction,
not just the sexual satisfaction, you know.
So what do you mean by pleasure?
Whatever, you know, your interest. So that is actually in the philosophy, the philosophy of politics.
Okay.
It was John Stuart Mill who started actually this trend and this movement.
Mm, yes.
That it's the most pleasure, the most
benefit
for the majority of the people.
Yes,
and actually they didn't abide by that too. You know, it was not for the majority. You know, soon after, the majority of people turned into the minority of people.
Yes.
So now we see that, you know, the values of the Western countries are in favor of a minority over there, and they are actually sacrificing whatever stands in front of that ideology that they have, you know, that this strategy, the Western strategy of the, you know, the interest and the
recently there was a documentary made about Harry Potter. And the interesting point was that the main author of the Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling, was not in that documentary. Now, the audience asked why? Because J.K. Rowling is against LGBT. Mm. See?
Interesting.
she was against, and the producer did not let her in. Because she supported recently another black writer, you know, who was against LGBT. So many other artists too, for example, in the media, in the cinema, in the movie, in the cinematic form, the artistic form, those people who are against LGBT have no place. They will lose their jobs, okay?
Yeah.
And again, I do want to say, these new formats that day by day through media, television, especially the movies that they are making, you know, is changing the thoughts of the people around the world, that let's experience new forms of cohabitation or relationship with the same gender or with the opposite gender. And this is, I think, a tragedy for the world. The foundation of the family is missing its place day by day.
See, you're true about this, but, you know, people need to do a little bit research, and that'll help them a lot. You know, if you do a little research, you will realize that all this is part of their social experimentation. Let me quote one of the documentaries. It's called Century of Self. It's got four parts to it by Edward Bernays. By another guy. The main character he's portraying there is about Edward Bernays, how he approached the whole scenario there. So there he talks about this social experimentation that they conducted in America, and that led to the hippie culture. And he uses a term in that documentary. He says sex revolution. He says, he clearly uses the term, and he says, look, people earlier were bound to their family. They were living within the family. And then they felt that, you know, the limitation of not being able to get involved with others. And as part of the social experimentation, they were told, they were T groups, you know, focused T groups where they were allowed to open up and speak and do whatever they want. And then encouraged to mix with more than one person at a time. And then suddenly they felt the freedom to be able to do it, and didn't see it as a taboo anymore. And then suddenly the whole environment turned into that hippie culture and sex revolution. And then they also realized that being bound to one person, and let's say it was the mistake to marry one person, but they realized that commitment was one of their problems. They're scared to commit to one person. And that's why they feel that, let's not commit to any anyone. I will live with this person. If I like him, I'll carry on for another 40, 50, 60 years. But somewhere in between, I find him not compatible with me. I'm not committed to this person. So I can quickly leave this person and go. So this is part of their social experimentation, that they rolled it out in a planned approach.
The same revolution that made, increased the rate of drug use.
Correct.
Especially after Vietnam War.
Correct.
Also abortion, you know.
Correct.
Wow. Out of children, out of wedlock. How many children out of wedlock because of the sex revolution in the U.S.? And when the sociologists and psychologists take a look back at that period, say that this is the darkest age and darkest time for the U.S. citizens around the world. And, you know, just a simple look at the pictures and the lifestyle of the people, even in the U.S. before 60s, 50s, you could find such haya and modesty even in the clothing.
Exactly.
See? Yeah. But nowadays, you know, as naked as an animal. Is it so?
I'll allow Sheikh Qasim to answer that. Yes. But not just West, Brother Atta.
Yes.
You would see that attitude even in the East. You know, if you go back and look at the pictures of women in India 50 years ago.
Shrouded,
Yeah, they would actually cover the head. Yes. They would actually pull their your covering over the head so much further down that it literally covered their face, more like a niqab, right? Yes. So the Hindu culture also had something called covering the head and covering the face to the extent of niqab. But then it's the exploitation of the Western culture.
The chastity.
Exactly. The so that led to the desanctifying the chastity of women and, you know, encouraging them to reveal more and cover less.
You know, I think we've been talking about the philosophy or, you know, the underlying layers of this sort of actually the deviation in the West and, as you said, even in the East. And again, I believe that that's you know, the way that they look at this world, and they are actually looking at the people like, you know, some workers that are there in order for working for them. So the more they are committed, the less they work, you know.
Okay.
So I think that works to their interest in the best way by having, you know, or promoting the ways of lives that have less commitment. So these sorts of relationships out of wedlock.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Qasim and Sheikh Qasim, for your presence in the program Viewpoints. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Viewpoints. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Iyan Call of Islam page, also a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I when I have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know that amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, know that you exist. You are the light that guides me through my darkest nights. Shows me right from wrong in a world that often lies. Cause I don't need anyone, anything in life but you.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
In the US, a measure of the inflation that the Federal Reserve watches closely accelerated again in January, hitting a new 40-year high and speeding up on a monthly basis as food and energy prices climbed sharply. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Gianna Smialek and Ben Castleman. The piece is titled, "A key inflation gauge is still rising, and war could make it worse." In the US, a measure of inflation that the Federal Reserve watches closely accelerated again in January, hitting a new 40-year high and speeding up on a monthly basis as food and energy prices climbed sharply. The Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, which the US Federal Reserve targets as its aims for 2% annual inflation on average over time, rose 6.1% over the past year, the fastest pace of increase since 1982. Prices climbed 0.6% in the month of January from December, up from 0.4% the prior month. The data released on Friday, 25th of February, by the Commerce Department was a fresh reminder that inflation remains stubbornly high. As Russia's war with Ukraine sends oil and other commodity prices higher and promises to continue to boost inflation. The U.S. Federal Reserve has been preparing to steadily pull back its pandemic-era economic support in an effort to cool off consumer demand and tame prices. The White House is monitoring inflation closely as rising prices for food, rent, and gas shake consumer confidence and dent President Biden's approval ratings ahead of midterm elections next November. The new inflation reading won't surprise economists or policymakers. The personal consumption expenditures number is fairly predictable because it is based on consumer price index figures that come out more quickly, along with other already available data. But it reaffirms that price increases, which were expected to prove temporary as the pandemic economy reopened, have instead lasted almost an entire year and seeped into areas not affected by the coronavirus. Rapid price increases have hit a wide array of products and services, including used cars, beef, chicken, restaurant meals, and home furnishings, and several trends risk keeping inflation elevated. Notably, wages are rising rapidly, and employers are finding that they can pass their climbing labor costs along to shoppers. Economists are also warily eyeing the conflict in Ukraine, which has already caused oil and gas prices to rise and is likely to further push up commodity costs. But some are also betting that the uncertainty it has spurred could inspire the US Federal Reserve to take a more cautious approach as it tries to slow down the economy. Stock prices rose on Friday as traders pared back expectations that the Federal Open Market Committee will make a large half percentage point rate increase in March in an effort to decisively tamp down inflation. Despite the prospect of higher inflation, the Russian war with Ukraine leads us to now think that the Federal Open Market Committee will raise rates by a more conservative quarter of a percentage point. Kathy Bosianchik, chief U.S. economist at Oxford Economics, wrote in Research Note on Friday. Researchers at Goldman Sachs estimate that an increase of $10 per barrel of oil would increase headline inflation in the United States by a fifth of a percentage point, while lowering economic output by just under a tenth of a percentage point. While it is not clear how much gas prices will shoot up, it depends on the depth of the conflict, the breadth of sanctions, and Russia's reaction. Several commodity prices jerked higher in the hours after the start of war with Ukraine. Brent crude oil, the global benchmark, rose to more than $100 per barrel on Thursday after the war began, before moderating again on Friday. There is still a risk that oil prices could climb further if Russia reacts to sanctions from the United States and Europe. Russia is a major exporter of energy to Europe. Some economists have noted an uncomfortable precedent when it comes to a gas shock. Rising energy prices in the 1970s helped exacerbate inflation, causing rapid price increases to become a lasting feature of the economy, one that faded only after a painful response from the U.S. Federal Reserve. The central bank pushed interest rates and unemployment to double digits to bring price increases to heel during what is now known as the Great Inflation. That episode happened after years of quick price increases that the Fed had proved slow to tamp down. This time, the central bank is gearing up to pull back support promptly. The Federal Reserve is expected to initiate a series of rate increases in March, policy moves that should slow down lending and spending, which could translate into weaker hiring, more subdued economic growth, and more modest price gains. The Ukrainian situation does not alter, likely, the fundamental conclusion that it's time to change monetary policy, said Julia Coronado, founder of Macro Policy Perspectives. They're not going to just shelve all the interest rate increases because there is a war in Ukraine. Christopher Waller, a U.S. Federal Reserve governor, said during a speech on Thursday evening, 24th of February, that the conflict could contribute to uncertainty, but that for now, the Fed should promptly pull back its support for the economy to try to control alarmingly high inflation. He suggested that if Friday's inflation report, along with other upcoming data, indicate that the economy is still running exceedingly hot, a strong case can be made for raising interest rates by half a percentage point in March, twice the usual size of increase. Fed officials appear to be poised to debate whether a bigger-than-usual increase is warranted at their meeting next month. While the Fed officials target headline inflation, it also keeps a careful eye on a core price measure that strips out fuel and food costs, both of which bounce around from month to month. Core inflation picked up by 5.2% in January from the prior year, the quickest pace of increase since 1983. It has posted 0.5 percentage point monthly increases for four straight months. Annual inflation should start to slow down mechanically sometime in the coming months, as prices are measured against stronger readings from last spring, when inflation first started to pick up. Fading government support is also weighing on household incomes, which could eventually help cause spending to slow somewhat. But the moderation in price increases could prove more muted than economists and policymakers had previously expected, thanks in part to the potential for rising energy costs as the conflict in Ukraine escalates. While the Federal Reserve has primary responsibility for controlling inflation by guiding economic demand, the White House is trying to roll out policies to help supply catch up and has pledged to do what it can to keep oil and gas prices from rising to untenable levels during the Russian conflict. I know this is hard and that the Americans are already hurting, Joe Biden said during an address on Thursday. I will do everything in my power to limit the pain the American people are feeling right now at the gas pump. This is critical to me, but this aggression cannot go unanswered. Rising fuel prices are painful for consumers, but economic policymakers typically try to look past them when setting policy because energy costs are so volatile. But officials are closely watching to see if inflation continues to broaden into categories that have been less driven by pandemic-tied supply constraints like rent and other services. Strong consumer spending has helped to fuel the increase in prices, giving companies the wherewithal to charge more. Friday's report also showed that personal outlays climbed by 2.1% in January from the prior year, beating the central analyst forecast in a Bloomberg survey.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.